You know, it was capitalism, after all, I think is a great first line of this book. Don't expect them to save you. They like money. They're not our gods. They are not our saviors. They are not here to help us. They are here to eat us.
Welcome to Technovation. I'm your host, Peter High. My guest today is Kara Swisher. Kara doesn't need much of an introduction, but I'll provide one anyway. She's one of the most influential thinkers in the world of technology and beyond. She's interviewed most of the great business leaders and innovators of our time. And her latest book, I've got it right here, Burn Book, A Tech Love Story, which is part memoir, part history of the past 30 plus years of technology, coinciding with her coverage of it. And in it, she shares her insights and analysis, her conclusions and frustrations, and much more. It's very entertaining and insightful. I've certainly recommended it to all who are listening and watching. She's the host of the On with Kara Swisher podcast and co-host of the Pivot podcast. She co-founded Recode and before that, co-produced and co-hosted the Wall Street Journal's D All Things Digital conference series with Walt Mossberg starting back in 2003. She's been a columnist at the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, among other periodicals as well. And now for a word from our partner, Nile, and the company's co-founder and chief executive officer, Pankaj Patel. Pankaj, talk a bit about the idea of network as a service, as this is a category you're pioneering, essentially.
Service is truly the new product. We really wanted to mold this in a way where AI truly drives the closed loop automation, because we saw this as a major hole in the way the networks were today. This is where we realized that data is the secret ingredient for what we are doing. Every facet of our life is dependent on connectivity and networking today. So we will say, before you design any piece of hardware, software, or firmware, ask yourself a question. Do you really need this? Focus on what is truly needed to deliver a service. After you have decided that you are going to need this, simplify it to the nth degree. Simplification is the key. After that, we said, let's automate everything that we are doing. Doing all of this, we were able to simplify and automate 95% of the usual things people encounter in the IT shop. You cannot do this with the product mindset. This is what we had to do in order to create the true service offering.
Thanks, Pankaj. And now on to our broadcast. I could go on, but we might as well get into the conversation. Kara, welcome. I'm so delighted to speak with you today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Well, Kara, congratulations on your book. As I say, it's a terrific read. I thought we'd begin with a story you tell early in the book about the loss of your father, Louis Swisher, when you were 5 years old. Mm-hmm. He had a brain aneurysm. You have some moving stories to share about that. And certainly he's somebody who looms large to this day in your life. You also talk about your stepfather and the important role that he played, even if not always a positive one. And I wonder if you could take a moment and reflect upon the formative relationships you had with your father and stepfather.
My dad was a saint. I'm sorry. I mean, I know you say that when people die young, they tend to get saint-like qualities, but my dad was a genuine saint, I think. I wrote a story many years later about moving his body. My grandmother asked me to, and I got dozens of letters to people who knew him and hundreds of letters to people who didn't. Some friends of his and people he helped, there was a gay couple who wrote me say he was nice to them when people weren't nice to them. There were just all kinds of people. He was kind. He was a kind person. And, you know, he came from modest means, and he went to college and medical school using the Navy. And he was in the Navy, as a doctor. He changed his life. He transformed him, a little entrepreneur, I guess. But he died right when he was starting his life. He had three kids. He had just gotten out of the Navy, paid his dues for that. And it was over. And so it affected me in a very profound way, because I really became aware at a young age that life is ephemeral, not just ephemeral, but sudden, random, unfair. So it sort of steeled me in a good way through a bad situation, I guess, in that regard. I have a lot of, they call it resilience now. It's not my favorite word, but I have a lot of that and pushing through. My stepfather was another story, but another cruel way to learn probably some good qualities. He was an entrepreneur. He was clever. He taught me about strategy and all kinds of things in a very unnice way. I'm not Cinderella, but I had a not very nice stepfather. So I think you get it toughened me up, both things, through grief and also through bad parenting, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I try to take away lessons, even if they're negative, and we all have them, and try to push through. And I do think that's a quality of entrepreneurs in the people I covered later.
Well, speaking of negative stories, you also write about your desire in college to go into military intelligence. But as a lesbian, you realized that you would have to make compromises you didn't want to make. Primarily, you'd have to lie about being gay. Obviously, you've found a remarkable alternative to that. But I wonder if you can reflect upon some of those early realizations and the way in which it led to an important pivot for you.
Not just that, they didn't let you in.
That's exactly. That's right.
I didn't like, oh, do you think they'll like me if I'm gay? No, they didn't like you if you were gay, and they would kick you. They would throw you out with a dishonorable discharge at the time I wanted to do it. And then at the same time, there was don't ask, don't tell later. Anytime I had an opportunity possibly to shift it, you know, we had a lot of military in my family, my father's side of the family, and I really have great regard for the military. I know a lot of people don't, but I do. I just think, you know, it can bring people up in the world. And there's a lot of military people I meet now, especially at the higher levels, are very sharp cookies. They just have chosen a life of service versus a company. And so I wanted to do that, but I couldn't. It wasn't an option open to me because of being gay. I always joke, I could, you know, they could ask and I could tell, you know what I mean? And that's the problem. And then later when it became okay, I was too old. I was far too old to join even the reserves by the time they really did the right thing, which was everybody is qualified to be in the military if they have the interest and the energy to do so. And so I didn't do it. And so I could have been a spy, I guess. I could have been a lot of things. I was more interested in analysis, which is kind of what a reporter does, like brings together disparate information and finds things out and then comes to a conclusion. And I was good at that.
Well, you would go on to become a journalist and a very impactful one. So despite that unfortunate necessity to pivot, it's one that we've all benefited tremendously from. You write about how at a fellowship at Duke University, you downloaded a Calvin and Hobbes collection, a book, and it led to an insight that you wrote about, a quote of yours that's quite insightful and famous. You said, "Everything that can be digitized will be digitized." I wonder if you could take a moment and talk a bit about that experience and that revelation.
I loved reporting. I didn't start doing it till college, though. I had studied communications at college. I went to the Foreign Service School at Georgetown, which was sort of a way station into the CIA and the State Department. A lot of people who've been there went on to that. And I had spent a lot of time thinking about propaganda. That was an area I wrote a paper on it at Columbia. I wrote about it at Georgetown a lot and studied it, Nazism, China, all uses and positive uses of propaganda, by the way, to get populations doing something. And so I was super interested in how the Overton window. I just was very interested in how thoughts change and how people can be manipulated. Easily. I was obsessed with the Salem witch trials and McCarthyism, all those things. And so I went into a lot of it with a lot of interest in it. And when I saw, when I was able to download this book and start to use the early internet, and it was pretty crude at the time, even before that, there was things like FTP and Gopher and stuff like that. You could tell what it could do if you had a worldwide network of information, right? Before you make a phone call to like Russia was hard. I happened to be dating someone there, but you could do it online and you could see things. And the early stuff was silly. One website was looking at a coffee brewing at a tech academic thing, you know, but you could see where it could go. And when I downloaded that book, it was like, so everything will be anything that is digitizable or anything that could be made digitized, it would happen. It had to happen. It was inevitable. And that was my one very good insight. You only need one, by the way.
I don't think that's quite
right. I've had a couple.
Well, I you mentioned your concentration at SFS at Georgetown in propaganda. Mm-hmm. This mm-hmm. came out again in a really interesting way in the book where you talk about quoting the last lines of Yeats' poem, Second Coming to the Google executive team, and what rough piece it's our come round at last.
Yeah. I was writing a story when they were trying to take over Yahoo or at least get control of it. And I thought that was a monopoly position. And so I compared them naturally, since I had also covered that, the Microsoft trial where they lost the case. with Judge Jackson way back. And I said, you know, at least Microsoft knew they were thugs when they were, I thought it was thuggish what they were trying to do. And I said so in on my site. And I knew I had covered those guys from an early stage when they were in the garage at Susan Wojcicki's house. Very close to the very early Google. I was a very early Google reporter, essentially. And so I saw what they were doing. And it was the same thing, except they sort of had this sort of, you know, fun, colorful, look at our primary colors. Aren't we fun and wacky? But they were the same. They were doing the same thing, right? They were doing exactly the same thing that Microsoft was doing, but they were pretending because they were friendly that they weren't, because Microsoft had that aggressive reputation, essentially. And so, or mean, really, a mean reputation, a bullying reputation. And so I was like, I don't care if you're friendly or you're bullying, you're the same person. And so, you're doing the same thing. And so I had written a pretty tough piece where I called them thugs, and they got mad at me and they called me and said, you know us, we're really nice. And I kept trying to explain to them that it wasn't them that I was talking about. It was the rough beast slouching towards Bethlehem waiting to be born. And I was like, every single technology has been used as a weapon by malevolent people. I'm not concerned with you. I'm concerned with what's next. And they just, because of the lack of historical knowledge or lack of interest in it, really, they don't care. Or that they think they're so special that they're going to be immune from humanity. I was gobsmacked that they didn't understand what I was talking about and what was going to happen inevitably. Because there's never been a tech that's not used for bad. It just isn't.
And you talk a lot about how Silicon Valley leaders, especially, and tech leaders more generally speaking, often have arrested mm-hmm. development of a kind, almost like children. They think about benefits without thinking about consequences.
Right, right. That's, you know, I have a lot of kids. They don't think about consequences. If I jump here, will I break my arm? I don't think that's ever one of their considerations when my son is flipped upside down, or even my older son's. My older son this week was doing, I was in Ann Arbor, he's at University of Michigan, and he did something. I was like, do you have any idea what could happen? And, you know, of course he doesn't, nor does he, you know, nor does he care. And he shouldn't, because he's young. And so until, you know, it's all fun and games till someone loses an eye, kind of thing. You learn that later in your life. I just felt like either they didn't think about it. They had no historical basis to imagine it could happen. You know, no anticipation of consequences, which is always fascinating to me. Or didn't they care at all because they never paid the price? That to me was that penny dropped later, that they didn't care, nor did they feel unsafe. And therefore, what do they care if things are unsafe? Because they're not going to be unsafe. And that's obviously a selfish way of looking at it, but I think it fits.
Yeah. You also note the comparison between Star Trek versus Star Wars narratives. That you hoped it would be Star Trek, and you realized it was Star Wars. Talk a bit about that insight.
Well, I had done an interview with Steve Jobs, which I had forgotten about. When I went back and found it, I was like, yay, a metaphor I can use. But he had talked about, I like Star Trek. Where's Star Trek? Well, he and I were the same age, or he's slightly older than I am. But obviously, he's dead now, but we were the same group of people. And he talked about the idea of what Star Trek did to us, this idea of a united commercial of Benetton. They're all getting along. Villains change their mind and become good and work for the common good and stuff like that. And so that's a very sunny view of technology. There's a lot of technology in that show, even though it seems kind of silly and crude now. But there is. There's a lot. There's the phaser, the communicator, all kinds of stuff that exists today. Like when Uhuru has that thing in her ear, that's an AirPod, right? Or computers say this, that's Siri, right? Or whatever you're doing, or Hello Google. And so that's a sunny view. And then there's Star Wars, which I've interviewed George Lucas, by the way, and we've had a long talk about it. Star Wars is a Holocaust metaphor. Really, it is. He says so. And it's about evil winning. Evil wins. It wins a lot. And it wins in a devastating, they destroy planets. It's not it's not a loser the way that it often is portrayed. And it's not a loser thing. It actually has benefits to be evil. And even good people are evil, and bad people sometimes can be good. But nobody wins in this eternal struggle. they sometimes do and sometimes they don't. It goes on and on. And so that really struck me as the way it was, is that this group of people who should have been Star Trek was Star Wars, and you didn't know who the villain actually was. The hero could turn into a villain. Welcome to Elon Musk, for example. Good example. He's perfect. He's Darth Vader, I guess, in the early days. Yeah. Anakin.
Well, you mentioned Steve Jobs, and mm-hmm. you have numerous anecdotes about him, understandably, through your book as well. You interviewed him many times, probably no better an interview than the 2007 interview you and Walt Mossberg did with him.
That's a historical document.
Really incredible. And for those who haven't listened to it recently, I've listened to it a couple of times just in recent days in preparation for this. It really is extraordinary.
And it is. Also, FYI, just so you know, when Steve died, we knew News Corp owned that video, the copyright to it, right? And the IP, they own the IP. So right when Steve died, and Steve knew Rupert and tried very hard to shift his mentality politically, which people don't know as well. It's been written about, but he did. He was always trying to engage with Rupert Murdoch because he wanted to change people's minds, which I really appreciated. Didn't work. He died too soon. But he, they owned it. And so we got Rupert to make it free for all of humanity for the rest of the world. And every now and then I'll get a note saying, we own the copyright. I go, actually, you don't anymore. He made it available. So I urge people to watch that. And now you can without News Corp stopping you.
Yeah. Is it fair to say that he Jobs is the leader you admire most? I mean, he had his flaws, as everyone does, but mm-hmm. you call out so nicely just the vast array of areas that he influenced.
He was a visionary in a lot of ways, and he's not the technologist in the sense. He's a little like Elon in that regard, much less of a technologist than a business and a visionary, a product. He's a product.
Less than Gates, for example.
Gates is a business visionary, I would say. I would give him that credit. And a philanthropy. He's done rather well in philanthropy. He's doing some interesting things in climate change tech now and vaccines. He's certainly he's become more of a visionary in a lot of ways. I think they need to have that. But Steve Jobs was the real deal, like really did see around corners. He talked about earliest person I ever talked about podcasting with, earliest person I talked about the problems of social media business model with was Steve Jobs. Earliest person to talk about the phone in the pocket, the computer in your pocket kind of stuff. Now, there had been versions of that, and one of them was an Apple version that they had tried a number of times. They had tried it a number of times. So he was always sort of he always saw around corners, removing things from the sides of computers, removing hard disks. You know what I mean? Like he did that before everybody else. People forget. And it took at some risk to him from a business point of view. And so he had a vision, and it was his vision, by the way. I also appreciated that. He wasn't trying to please. The only time he tried to please was when they did a social network called Ping, and it was a disaster, and he knew it. He was following the crowd. So I always appreciate someone like that. Now, look, was he the nicest guy in the world? Absolutely not. That said, compared to today, he looks like a sweetheart, doesn't he? Like, he's just funny and quirky and just kind of, a few thorns here and there. But interestingly, I did an interview. I have a lot of people doing interviews with me on this book tour. But Ted Sarandos was like, now, Kara, he wasn't that nice. He yelled at us. And I said, can I ask you what he yelled at you for? And it was because they were working on the app in the App Store for Netflix, and he didn't like the red they were using, right? And he thought it was bad. He said it looked terrible. And I said, so he was arguing with you about product. It was about making the product better. And I'm like, I kind of am okay with that. Like, maybe he shouldn't have yelled, but I kind of get it. Like, your color was shitty. He was mad. He cared about things like that. And I said, did he ever call you a moron? And he's like Elon does on a daily basis to people, or call you names. And he goes, no, he just didn't like the red. And I said, I'm good with that. The red sucked. So there you have it. I don't know. He had a lot of, he parked badly. There were issues around how he treated one of his children, although that particular child got equal amounts of money when he died. So I don't know. He was a complex figure. I don't discount some of his, sharp characteristics, but again, next to the new people, he looks lovely.
Yeah. And a lot of the people you've covered have been sharp characters. One thinks of Gates and Bezos, for example.
Gates. Gates was such a jerk. I mean, so was Mark Cuban. So was Ivan Spiegel. Now, the ones I like have progressed. That's mm-hmm. what I like, is progression. And so I don't mind if you started off a jerk and you changed, or you improved, or you got better. I like that. I'm not going to hold you to, like, right now, I kind of like Liz Cheney. Trust me, I don't like Liz Cheney, but here I am liking Liz Cheney. You have to give people room to change. So
that's a great point. Certainly. I want to talk a little bit more about your story. You were a rare person in journalism who started keeping track of the money you brought in relative to what you cost
Very
your employers. Now, that was really interesting. And as you point out, rare in your industry, to
Very
say
much.
Rare in a lot of industries. And why did that occur to you to do that?
Well, look, first of all, media people are the most risk averse people in the world. So it's really interesting. Among the most risk have been, and it's to their detriment. Secondly, I was very aware, because I was covering retail for the Washington Post, what was happening to the economic underpinnings of the Washington Post during this era. And it started with Walmart, not with tech. Walmart came in and closed down all the, you know, really decimated local retail. And that was one of the underpinnings. When I saw Craigslist, it was very clear what it would do to classifieds. Anyone not paying attention was not paying attention if they didn't understand the implications of a global network of classified information. Same thing with free news, how it affect, that meant you had to, if you were having a subscription business, you had to have something everyone really wanted versus just that's available everywhere, news that's available everywhere. So I was paying a lot of attention to it. And largely because I understood that if you didn't make money, you weren't going to stay in business. You know what I mean? If costs and revenues didn't align in some fashion, with less costs and more revenues, that was going to be a problem. And so I felt it was about power. If I was making money, they could not question what I was doing. And if I wanted to do innovative things and I made money, it was, they couldn't like pull the rug out from under me. And so I never wanted the rug to be pulled out from under me. So every business I ran had profits. Because then what do you do? Like, what are they going to do? Tell you, you know, then they did. That's why we left News Corp, because we were making a ton of profits. Not huge, but good. Like, who makes millions for their owner, right? You know, and they were, you know, they still didn't want to invest even after we made the millions. And so, you know, that was interesting. That was an interesting moment when we left News Corp.
Yeah, indeed. And
but you have to be able to leave. That's the thing. I left. I, like a lot of people, want to hold, you know, desperately onto whatever job they have. I'm like, I have options. And by the way, I can also bus tables if I need to. I've always had that point of view.
I was just going to say, I mean, having that personal P&L had to have given you so much more confidence to take the leap. You know, it feels also, like a risk, but you recognize, wait a second, I've made money. I'm making money. I can continue to make money.
That's correct. I believe in myself, right? I'm a little like the tech people I cover. I'm going to go for me. Like, I feel like I'm pretty good at what I do. And I don't need this mothership attached to me. And as it became so clear, the internet, early internet, you could see personalities, fan bases developing. And again, I saw fans way before anyone. We have fans of Pivot. That's what we have. We have listen audience, but they're fans. They love what we make. And you had to be three things. I kind of had this other epiphany around the three things to success in media. You had to be useful, meaning in some way. I don't know what it is. Could it take all kinds of forms, like a good recipe, whatever, useful, or news that was useful, or an insight that was useful that you could use at work. You had to be interesting slash substance. In my case, substance was very important. But you had to be interesting, entertaining, something that people would want to watch. Interesting, not boring, right? That was another thing. The third thing, which I think is critically important, was it cannot be replaceable, which is must have. There is nobody like Scott and I on Pivot. There's just not. And you can't get it anywhere else, since you got to come to us if you want to eat this particular donut, right? This is the donut. We make the donut. No one has our secret recipe or can't get it or can't do it. And so if you have all those things, you can find an audience, however big or small, and you can make money, however big or small. So that's always been my recipe.
Talk a bit about, you've had great collaborators. Obviously, you've been a lone wolf and continue to be on a number of your projects, but you've between Walt Mossberg and Scott Galloway, to name two. Talk a bit about your collaborations and how meaning you draw from that.
I sometimes do things by myself. Sometimes I do it with a team. Sometimes I do with a significant team member, such as Walt. Walt was so much more famous than I was when we started. I think I had more entrepreneurial zest than he did, but he this guy was covering the Defense Department, was top of the world, and he left to write about like gadgets. That was not a career move many would have done, right? But he loved it. He had a passion for it. He was good at it. And it became the economic engine of the Wall Street Journal, by the way. On those Thursdays, he made millions of dollars in advertising for them. And he got a piece, he was well paid for it, right, at the time, deservedly. So in a lot of ways, he is entrepreneurial. I shouldn't say he's not.
And you dedicated your book to him as well.
I did. He deserves it. He also was a great mentor to me and very generous with his success. So he really carried me for the first couple of years. Then we carried each other. And then he retired and I was good. You know what I mean? Generosity is something that is not seen in entrepreneurship as much, how important it is, generosity. And, you know, people always go luck or grit. I think generosity is a bigger deal than you think, people really helping you. And he was a great mentor to me, and it very different, very amazing reporter, amazing person with a point of view. He and I developed this theory of press as more than just reporting, but a point of view, coming to the conclusion after you did the journalism, which Walt was the expert in, I think, really. And he changed reviews in that regard, especially tech reviews. And Scott is just kismet. The minute we got together, we really disagreed beautifully, I think. And I think one of the things that is happening in our society is there's so much disagreement. And people say things like, let's agree to disagree. That's not good. Then you don't agree, right? And so one of the things that Scott and I do, and I've noticed it on this book tour, because a lot of the people that come to these events that I'm doing are love the podcast or like, or on or whatever. But he and I really learn from each other. We learn how to agree, actually. And we don't always agree, but we learn how to, or try to get there, or we have an earnest effort to do so. And it's funny. Like, again, it's funny. It's also useful. It's the same thing I'm talking about. And I think that's at the heart of that. And listen, a politically incorrect white guy, rich white guy, and me was not the combination I would have picked. But once we did it, it was clear that we had that charisma together, that charismatic quality. And you know, other things I do by myself, all these interview, I don't want to do an interview with someone. I just like to do my interviews, and I'm good. I've gotten good at it over the years, largely via practice. I was pretty snarky and not as good at the beginning, and Walt was better. And he really taught me how to listen and how to ask questions. But I had a style, which was in your face a little bit, not mean, but in your face. And I just kept developing that. And it's changed. It's also changed over the years. I'm very interested in information now more than I am in scoring points. Because I think people need information more than ever now.
Yeah, great points. You've referred to yourself as a pessimistic optimist. And it struck me that your book title is exactly that. It's Burn Book, the Mean Girls reference, but it also references a tech love story.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about those two sides of you.
It's about a love gone wrong, right? Every love goes wrong, right? That's the best story ever. Like, everyone pays billions of dollars for love gone wrong. And it doesn't have to be romance. You know, it doesn't have to be romance. It's something you loved and the scales fell from your eyes. I think that's what the story's about. It's about if I had to pick a character, it would be Nick in The Great Gatsby. I'm Nick. Oh, look at this. Not so pretty, right? Also beautiful. And so, you know, at the end of Great Gatsby, Nick is not cynical. He's learned. He's learned a thing or two, and he still loves part of it. And so I love tech. I think tech is transformative. I think it can change, like right now around cancer research, around climate change tech. I really believe in it. That said, everything that's been a tool has been a weapon. Everything. There's not a thing that hasn't turned into a weapon, you know, sugar. Like, always, often a weapon, actually, a weapon. Also delicious. I really do have that sense of that. And I think the book is about that. It's my journey with these people who have changed the world. And getting back to Walt, at one point he said, go in there with your cleats on, because these people are going to change the world, and I need you to keep them honest. And I think that was my job, and it's still my job.
Yeah. And it calls to mind, actually, a quote I know that you've noted from Paul Virilio.
Yeah, that's really struck a nerve with a lot of people, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, right? The ship, the adventure of the ship leads to the shipwreck, the train leads to the rail accident, this is something that continues with each innovation. And we're seeing it now with generative AI. I wonder what your reflections are now.
Not yet. We're not quite there yet. It's not killing people yet. You know, soon to a country near you. I think it's a really good example of that. It's when you met the ship, you met the shipwreck. It's a really easy idea to think about. So you have ships full of goods that are making a lot of people rich, and you have shipwrecks that the rest of us are paying for, right? The ones who aren't making the money, shipwrecks that are devastating. You don't have a lighthouse. Why is that? Where's the lighthouse? Or a plane in a plane crash? Where's the radar? Why are there so many plane crashes and so many people making money on plane flights? Same thing with electricity. Why are there, electricity has benefited a very small number of people in this case. And then there's electrocution, and there's a lot of wires on the ground without any covering, and we have to touch them. Why is that? Why aren't there covering? Why aren't they in the like, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about, you know? And I think it's a really important thing to imagine is every single, you know, Brad Smith from Microsoft is the one who wrote the book Tools and Weapons, which it's going to be both, but let's mitigate the weapon part of it and stress the tool part of it, the thing that can help us. And that's what's, you know, electricity, is it a good or bad thing? Probably good, right? Yeah, mostly, but not so much here. Cars, you can do that with almost every invention. You could go through a list of pluses and minuses.
All the way back to fire.
Fire, fire. See, they're gonna warm. It's either gonna warm you or burn your house down.
There you go.
That's
Exactly.
a famous. I think it's Mae West or Joan Crawford. I think.
How can I ask, how do you use generative AI?
Well, it doesn't exist yet. I mean, technically, it doesn't exist. You're right. It's not gotten to cognitive. I think generative, I believe, and I think I'm correct in this. It's got to be self-aware kind of thing. But this is strong. I'll call it strong AI. Okay, this is where we're headed. First, there was narrow AI, which has been around forever. People, AI has been around forever. Machine learning, et cetera. I think I use it. I use it all the time. I don't know what I'm going to use it for. I use it for the ending of the book a little bit, just as a joke. I use it just to get information. Hey, give me a recipe for this. I try to use it widely the same way when I first got the iPhone. Like I tried out all the apps, right, as they started to come online. Some of them, they sit on my phone. I haven't used them in years. Some of them I use all the time. I try to figure out what they're for, or if they're addictive. Like the Uber app is not addictive, correct? It is not. It's just an app. It's a useful utilitarian app. And you know, you can have issues with Uber, the company, but in the case of as an app, it's not addictive. And so I try everything out. I don't think I have the imagination to have. If I had been that smart at the beginning of the iPhone, I would have figured out Airbnb before they did, or Instagram, or anything else.
You mentioned that among the lessons you hope people draw from your book is that guardrails are not necessarily a bad thing.
No, there's been no guardrails so far. That's the issue. There's been no industry this big that has never had any guardrails. There's just hasn't. I think they slipped in at a time when we have political dysfunction, and therefore, this is as if Standard Oil didn't have, or you know, Teddy Roosevelt didn't exist during this era, right? And the trust busters didn't exist, and they would have run everything. These oligopolies, they would have had not our government intervened. The same thing with Microsoft. The same thing with the AT&T. You know, you wouldn't have your cell phone if AT&T wasn't broken up. I know there's a debate about that, but I believe that. And I think one of the things you have to keep in mind is like, what this technology was paid for by the US taxpayer. So where's the benefit to us? Where's the bigger benefit? Mapping and dating services? I don't think so. You know, let's try to focus in on the things that are bigger and more important. And everything should not be privatized. It's like the broadcast spectrum. You know, those big TV companies made a lot of money, but there is an element of the civic good for some of this stuff, and especially around healthcare and other things like that. You know, it shouldn't be a device for addiction and malfeasance. These devices should promote things that are, you know, diagnostics, education, all kinds of stuff. And one of the things, another thing is storytelling. I think a lot about what I do is storytelling. I think a lot of what all journalists do is storytelling, and it's a powerful thing with human beings. Now we don't tell each other stories, we tell each other grievances, and that's born a lot. That's not a story, that's a grievance. And we tend to do that because this is what the medium has become about.
Interesting. What do you, as you note, this is not a time where government's doing a lot that's productive necessarily, but what role do you think optimally government plays in regulating this?
Any role. You know, they don't have any. So I take one. They should have a privacy bill. There should be an antitrust, should be updated. There should be an algorithmic transparency bill. Oh my God. Go look over. I just did an interview with Margrethe Vestager, who I've done a dozen interviews with. Go listen to that, because she just passed three or four bills that look kind of cool. You know, the Digital Services Act, the Digital Markets Act. You know, we may not want everything in there, and there's a lot of quibble with that. But like, you know, that's around content moderation. That's around safety, around a dominance of a market. Like, it's not that hard. This is not hard. It's just our legislators instead spend time, like Josh Hawley did at the recent hearing with Mark Zuckerberg. He asked him to apologize to the parents whose children had been hurt by, which he didn't do, by the way. But that's neither here nor there. He never does it. you know, he asked them to apologize. And I literally, Scott and I were like, turn around and look, like, Josh Hawley, you friggin' apologize to these people for not passing any laws instead, you malignant peacock. That's all you do. You don't create, you don't save their lives for them. And guess what? I wonder who among all of us has the ability to do so. Congress.
Yeah. Are you surprised that the trillion-dollar companies have not been scrutinized by the DOJ more than they have? That there hasn't been an effort.
Slow
to...
going. They're under-resourced. You know, they're under Senator Klobuchar. Amy Klobuchar, who I think is a terrific public servant. On the other hand, compared to Josh Hawley, although he has a bill that I like, so I'm going to be nice to him. You're not a malignant peacock. You're just a
you take that back.
No, I don't. You are a malignant peacock. Just pass the friggin' bill around. Different things. I don't care what you do, but just pass the bill. She was, you know, she just passed, she had finally, only thing she could get passed was this merger fees increase. And they're trying to take it away from the Justice Department and the FTC. And these people need, they're under-resourced by a factor of million. And so, you know, these are slow going and the technology moves faster than the market moves faster than the Justice Department. And so they're looking at the right places. But I unfortunately think the time might have passed. You know, things have changed again. And that's the problem. That is really a big problem.
Interesting. You start the book. The very first line of yours in the book is, as it turned out, it was capitalism after all. Sort of a thread through this conversation, actually, just the way in which power corrupts. And I wonder, like, are there, you talk about Brian Chesky, for example, as a counterpoint to this, perhaps, that there are examples. One need not necessarily be.
Well, he's corrupt. Thoughtful. You know, I'll take anything at this point, right? I'll take someone who says, maybe I was wrong. You know, I'll take that. Okay. All right. Good. We're beginning. We're learning, boys. And it's all boys. I find him really interesting and thoughtful. And same thing with Evan Spiegel, progression. Mark Cuban, progression. He was a real tech bro. Now he's very thoughtful. And he talks about, he like acts like a human being that cares about something beyond his money or his influence or technology. He has a bigger viewpoint of society, which is important. I don't expect him to save society, but I expect him to think about it when he has such power, for example. And I do think that, it was capitalism after all, I think is a great first line of this book, because that's what it's like. Don't expect them to save you. They like money. Like, let me tell you, they're not our gods. They are not our saviors. They are not here to help us. They are here to eat us. They are here to eat us. And that is what capitalism does. And if you think anything else, you're lucky if they do anything else. But we need to protect ourselves. And I think that's, you know, if we think that capitalism has deleterious effects, and it doesn't all the time, I'm a capitalist, but I fully understand that, you know, the reason Mark Zuckerberg doesn't apologize to these people is because his shareholders are his audience, not these people. And so he doesn't open himself up to litigation because he can't be sued. But you know, that's why they're here for the money. They're here for the money. Let's stop pretending that they're no different than Wall Street or insurance or gas, you know, oil people. They're the same people. So
I wanted to ask you, as somebody I mentioned in the intro, just a portion of the things that you're involved in, which are many. How do you manage your time? How do you split your time across so many different activities and do such a great job?
My wife asks me that all the time. everybody suffers. No, I'm very efficient with my time. I don't have any assistants. I don't like assistants. I don't. I'm sorry. I'm very in charge of my time, and I parse it out the way I want to. And I know that sounds crazy because I get a lot now. It's getting a little much right now, especially around because the book's turned out to be a bestseller, which didn't surprise me. But I parse out my time. I spend a lot of time. I make sure I have time for my kids. It's the only place I say no to people. I just did today to a very important person. Was like, we have to have dinner. I'm like, no, I'm going to see my son. And he's like, can you change that? I'm like, I could, but I'm not going to for you. Sorry. Pick another time. I'm sure you have another time and you have, you know, babysitters, but I don't. I mean, I do have babysitters for my younger kids. So I tend to be very strict with my time. I'm very efficient. I think when people are busy, they tend to be more efficient. I do what I want to do. I think a lot of people don't, and things I don't want to do, I don't do. Like, I know it sounds dumb, but if I don't like someone or something, I say no a lot. I say no. I don't think, even if people see them as opportunities, I'm like, no. And I've done that my entire career, even when I didn't have as much clout as I obviously do now, or ability to make things happen. And I say no a lot, but I tend to get back to people directly. I did that with you. You know, you've been trying to interview me for a while.
Indeed.
And I keep notes. I'm like, oh, I haven't called him back. And I try not to be rude to people. That's another thing. Or I explain why I can't do it. You know, I don't like to have a lot of intermediaries between me and in this case, I have some great people. Simon and Schuster have been doing a great job because the incoming is so heavy, but that'll end soon, or in a month, I guess. And so I spend a lot of time thinking about my time. I don't vacation. I'll be honest. I don't vacation. I just don't. I work a lot. I like working. And I take moments for myself. I do quiet moments. I watch television has always been a something I have found solace in. And now television's used to be the boob tube. Now it's super smart. So I'll watch stupid things and smart things. I'm watching Shogun right now, and it's my time. Like, I don't watch it with people. I watch it by myself. And it quiets my mind, I guess. Instead of meditation, I watch Shogun, which is very bloody, but it's good.
As you look to the future, what are some things that make you optimistic?
Oh, a lot of things. I think some of this AI stuff around healthcare is really promising. Climate change tech could be really great. It's necessary. It's existential. I think, you know, the remaking of media is important. We finally have gotten our teeth kicked in enough times. We've got to figure it out. Like, you can do it on a, I've seen so many interesting smaller things happening that are pretty cool. I think a lot of them are the children of All Things D, right? If you think about it. I think a lot of people are willing to take risks in media. I'm not one of these. There's all these apocalyptic end of media stories. I'm like, oh, stop. Come on. Really? Come on. Like, same thing with, I just signed a deal with CNN to be on the show, The Chris Wallace Show, which I love. And everyone's like, Kara, in cable? What's she doing? It's because everyone was going, it's over. I'm like, is it? Really? Like, in the worldwide global network of information on every television set? That seems like you could do something with that. Like, you know, I find I'm a scavenger. I'm a cook, right? You can find beauty and food and meals and a lot of things other people don't see. I guess I do that. And I don't make a decision right away. Like, that's over. Like, the whole Trump thing. Trump's going to win. He's not going to win. I have studied it. He is not going to win. He's crazy. And people know it. And so that's where I'm going. I've done my analysis, and I will continue to change it as things change. But, you know, the same thing with Biden when everyone was calling him Weekend at Bernie's. I'm like, he's not. I've spent time with him. He's not. He's old. That's fine. And I get people being concerned. I get it. But I was like, the minute he's not Weekend at Bernie's, everyone's going to be like, what the hell were they talking about? And that's what happened with the State of the Union, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, look at him. He's not dead, right? I try to, like, there's a really big saying I use since I was in college, and I tried to find it. It was a plaque on the near the Foreign Service School where I went, and it said, I believe what I see. I don't see what I believe. So I believe what I see. That's mm-hmm. what I try to do.
I like that. I think one of the extraordinary things about your career is that you've not been limited to a single lane. Your lanes have expanded as your interests have expanded.
Podcasting. Nobody. Oh, are you kidding? Everyone was like, what are you doing? I gave up running All Things D. I was like, well, I want to do this because I think it's interesting. So
are there topics you've not covered that you would aspire to?
I've been covering a lot more cultural stuff and politics because it's so dovetailing with what's happening in tech. Tech needs to be regulated, and I'm interested in regulation. So I'm super interested in climate change tech. I just am. I have four children. I'm very interested in it. I have a stake in it. I mean, I'm old. It doesn't matter. You know, I'll be dead before the real bad things happen. But I think a lot about my kids and my kids' kids. So climate change tech is of great interest to me, and anything I can do years ago, I wrote a column in the New York Times that said the climate change technologist will be the world's first trillionaire. And I just made that up, but I was echoing the story. You remember the guy in Total Recall who was the head of Mars? He owned Mars.
Right. Yeah.
And he was a trillionaire. And I was
the
like,
Schwarzenegger movie.
Yeah, it was. I think it was John Lithgow who was the guy who owned Mars. But the shit that don't do the Colin Farrell version. I'm sorry. Colin. It wasn't very good. But the Schwarzenegger version was a spectacular story. And I think about that. Like, I think about that a lot.
Yeah. You know, well, speaking of spectacular stories, your book is one of those.
Thank you.
Burn Book, a tech love story. Certainly, again, recommend it. Kara Swisher, thank you so much for joining
me
today.
Thank you. I'm so sorry it took so long. Apologies.
No. Worth the wait.
Can I just say one more thing to you? Let me tell you. One thing that people get wrong about me is, you know, there's always this, she's so tough. And it often, especially with men, I'm sorry, veers into mean. I'm not mean. When people meet me, they're shocked. Because I think you can go a long way. You can be clear with people. You can be tough with people. And that's not unfair. That's actually very kind to them. And I think people are, I think one thing I, with reporters, being snarky doesn't make you powerful. It just doesn't. You just have to be, you have to know your stuff and be fair. And sometimes you're tough and sometimes you're interested. And I learned that definitely from Walt Mossberg. He liked things and he didn't like things. And he explained why. And I think that's what journalism is, explaining why you made the case you're making. And I think people should think about that a lot more as they move forward.
That's a fantastic note to end on as well. Kara, again, thank you so
thank
much.
You.
It's been a pleasure spending
All
time
right.
with you.
Thank you so much.